Good morning, everyone. My name is Gregory Williams. I'm from History of Art and Architecture at BU, and I am honored to be serving as the moderator for Language Matters, Discussing Difficult Texts, the first panel of today's forum. I, too, want to express my sincere thanks to Tamsin Flanders, Christine Diaria, and the staff at the BUCH, and especially to Susan Mizruki for guiding us through this process, for their hard work and generous spirit in organizing the event. Before I introduce our panelists, I'd like to offer a few brief, very brief, opening remarks. I think we are all well aware that pressing questions about freedom of speech have received substantial coverage in the press and in scholarly writing over the past several years. Whether in the form of polite debate or combative protests, students, faculty, and staff on college campuses across the country are testing and debating the norms of communication. Assuming that we understand and accept certain legal restrictions on freedom of speech in the broader public sphere, what are the communally determined limits of discourse in the academic context? The primary aim of this panel is to think concretely and specifically about how we, as teachers and advisors, can find language that empowers students to tackle difficult texts in ways that both acknowledge the challenge of our moment and provide the intellectual and communicative tools needed to generate a productive exchange. My own interest in the topic comes from 15 years of teaching controversial works of contemporary art in my BU classes. That's not the only thing I teach, but that does make up a part of my corpus of images, including discussion of the culture wars of the late 1980s and early 1990s, a period in which some of the current terms of debate first gained wide circulation. As an art historian, I group images of all kinds into the expansive category of difficult texts. Of course, textual language and visual language often work together to produce the kind of complex statements we plan to discuss today. So turning to our panelists, I'm grateful to them for offering reflections based on their own experiences of working in the classroom or the office to think about how we can foster open and honest debate on campus. To maximize time for conversation with the audience, I will keep my introductions succinct. If you would like more information about the panelists, please see the participant profiles on the forum website. They will present their short papers one after the other with no break for questions in between. So please send questions or upvote others' questions via the Slido app during and after the talks, or of course, think of questions you'd like to pose in front of the microphone once the talks are over. Instructions on how to use the system, as Susan mentioned, are printed on the back of the brochure. So to my left is Kimberly Arkin, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology. Next to her is Emily Gowan, a PhD candidate in the Department of English. She will be followed by Stephen Prothero, professor of religion. Next is Takeo Rivera, assistant professor in the English department. And completing the group is Crystal Williams, associate provost for diversity and inclusion. So welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming. Kimberly, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the introduction, and I just want to start by saying how honored I am to be part of this panel and participating in the forum today. So the panel is about tough texts, but I want to talk about a tough concept, particularly the difficulty of talking about cultural appropriation with my students. So many of you are probably familiar with this concept. At root, the contemporary fight against cultural appropriation assumes that certain kinds of artifacts and or bodily aesthetics, turbans, dreadlocks, headdresses, things like that, belong to particular cultural groups. People should therefore be careful about wearing or using or carrying objects or styles that are not theirs, particularly when they're a member of a majority culture appropriating the characteristics of less powerful, minoritized cultures. A very infamous example of the condemnation of cultural appropriation on college campuses took place at Yale in 2015 when the Intercultural Affairs Committee sent students an email at Halloween asking them to avoid wearing, quote, culturally insensitive costumes like turbans or feathered headdresses. In response, a white faculty member expressed frustration that young people were no longer allowed to be, quote, inappropriate or provocative. And many students were outraged by this comment, which seemed to suggest that the rights of white students to be provocative were being defended over and against the psychological and social well-being of minority students. So as a cultural anthropologist, my discomfort with accusations of cultural appropriation is not about some putative right to be provocative. I think that's the wrong approach. It goes deeper. Anthropologists are partially responsible for the notion of culture that grounds the very idea that cultural appropriation is problematic. And this idea of culture is, frankly, a simplistic reification. It refers to a clearly bounded set of artifacts and practices that somehow map neatly onto a clearly defined group of people who typically inhabit a geographically defined space. We call this the people equals culture equals territory equation. And it makes it seem like people have culture in the same way that they might have houses or horses or cars. Ever since the second half of the 20th century, when this culture concept gained popular traction, many anthropologists have sorely repented of it. And today, almost all anthropologists prefer less totalizing, homogenous, and bounded accounts of human groupness. So no good anthropologist will tell you today that a people has a culture. In addition, I've largely dedicated my work as a teacher to undermining students' certainties about the stability, naturalness, and universalism of the categories into which we typically slot people. This is not about pretending to be color and or culture blind, but I show students that the behavioral and physical characteristics used as markers of group distinction are contextually and historically contingent, and they're not only contingent. Often the cultural diacritica used to represent minority social groups are themselves the effects of unequal power relations. And this is true even when the traits assigned to a minority group appear positive or even neutral. So, for example, characterizing Native Americans as essentially good stewards of the earth has also been a way of suggesting that they're outside of civilization and its attendant forms of economic development. But for many of my students, just like those at Yale, fighting cultural appropriation is a way of speaking truth back to power, and most particularly white power. And it's simply unimaginable to them that I might view cultural appropriation differently. And yet, when they realize in my class on ethnicity and identity, when I'm trying to teach them about identity, they know I can't quite be saying the same thing they think I should be saying. So one student struggled to explain this last year, quote, "So I'm trying to understand here, but I can't imagine you're really saying this. You wouldn't say this, but I think I hear you saying cultural appropriation is okay." So what to do in this impasse? I reach for a concept, another tough concept, strategic essentialism, that was developed by the critical theorist Gayatri Spivak in the 1980s. It's a response to the nearly universal move in the social sciences since the 1970s to deconstruct all the seeming givens of the social world, revealing in the process the way that those givens are actually built and rebuilt. Spivak realized that this move to deconstruct everything could harm dominated minority groups, depriving them of a ground for collective mobilization and political action. Saying, in essence, that it's only the machinations of the powerful that make you think that you share biological or historical or cultural features with other members of your group denies a foundational identity to historically oppressed populations. As a result, for Spivak, essentialism, or the idea that there are given natural traits that define groups and the differences between them, can be a powerful weapon of the weak. Essentialism can work as a strategic way of fighting the status quo. And here my students breathe a sigh of relief. They get almost immediately that the fight against cultural appropriation can be understood as a manifestation of strategic essentialism. But the story doesn't end here. Strategic essentialism should not make them comfortable with a blanket condemnation of cultural appropriation. In fact, the strategic part of strategic essentialism demands further reflection. What kind of consciousness should accompany strategic essentialism? Is it enough that theorists like Spivak call the essentialism behind certain kinds of political claims strategic? Or do political actors themselves need to be conscious of the ways in which their appeals to essentialism are about political efficacy rather than the way things are? Furthermore, what might count as strategic? What kinds of change do appeals to essentialism need to promise? What kind of empowerment is produced by the defense of certain representations, turbans, headdresses, as authentic and exclusive attributes of particular groups of people? What are the conditions required to produce that empowerment? Alternatively, when and how might such images trap marginalized groups in subordinate social and economic positions? If other groups cannot appropriate cultural traits imagined as belonging to a marked minority, to what extent is there pressure to live within the bounds of a putatively authentic way of life? In other words, are there conditions under which the forms of minority self-essentialization built into fears of cultural appropriation actually shore up the structures of inequality that we're all seeking to oppose? And once they start thinking about these questions, we really start talking.
Thank you so much for that, Kimberly. Hi, everyone. I'm Emily Gowan, and I'm going to talk about teaching controversial texts. What do we mean when we say that a text is difficult? When speaking in terms of language, form, and aesthetics, difficulty is often something that scholars prize, and it's certainly something we aim to teach our students to appreciate. When assembling our syllabi, we imagine challenging our students to reason more deeply, think more carefully, and attend more keenly to nuance and complexity. And a difficult text is often the best training ground for such skills. But there's another kind of difficulty that some teachers have recently become more reluctant to bring into their classrooms, and that is public controversy. When a text or the person who wrote it violates the agreed-upon political or ethical standards of our own historical moment, inviting that text or author into the classroom can be uncomfortable, particularly if the controversy in question is unfolding in real time. But I'd like to make the case today for embracing controversial texts, just as we embrace texts that introduce our students to other forms of difficulty. Because if we don't allow our students to encounter challenging, self-contradictory, ideologically complex texts, along with the equally challenging artists who produce them in our classrooms, then we're depriving them of an essential component of a humanistic education. Perhaps the best example I can give you of what I mean by this is the work of Juno Diaz, an author who came under fire in the spring of 2018 for exploiting the very structures of power his work sets out to critique. In response to allegations that surfaced during the Me Too movement, Diaz was stricken from college and high school syllabi across the country, despite having served for many years as a mainstay in diversity-focused literature classrooms. Even after MIT cleared Diaz of sexual misconduct allegations, the public controversy surrounding the scandal cast a pall over interpretations of his oeuvre. Suddenly, stories that had been about representing the Dominican American experience in all its richness and complexity became about advancing a misogynistic agenda. When I introduced Diaz's stories in my classroom last fall, I first explained to my students that the choice to do so was controversial, and that the material they would encounter in the stories might be difficult for assault survivors to read. I gave them printouts of journalistic and scholarly reactions to the recent scandal, as well as his own New Yorker essay about being a survivor of childhood sexual abuse himself, published shortly before the writer Zinzi Clemens accused him of forcibly kissing her in a stairwell. I asked them to take all of these materials home, to sit with them, and to come back to the next class prepared to tell me whether they thought it was appropriate for me to have assigned his work in the course. Students' responses to this assignment demonstrated that they not only wanted to be given difficult texts like Diaz's, but that they also craved opportunities to participate in adjudicating the moral consequences of the art they were asked to study, something we rarely trust undergraduate students to do. Though unanimously in support of the Me Too movement and critical of Diaz's offense, the students in my class rejected the premise that their literary education should be restricted as a result of his transgressions. When I asked them if, by extension, they believed publishers should institute morality clauses, they also said no. Many of them loved reading Diaz's work, and they didn't think they were wrong to feel that way. Others had reservations, namely about rewarding bad behavior in the marketplace, but suggested that it should not be up to the reading public, or that it should be up to the reading public and not the publishers to decide whether or not to buy and read the work of writers like Diaz. Another student noted that it felt like a double standard to erase Diaz from the canon for transgressions that countless dead white authors' reputations had survived. Above all, students articulated feeling that it was an insult to their intelligence that arbiters of cultural production and literary education did not trust them to respond appropriately and sensitively to difficult literature and the controversies with which it's so often imbricated. The logic of the assignment and the course more generally was structured around interrogating three assumptions about how literature participates in public discourse. One, that literature, especially literature that announces a social purpose, must always help people without hurting them. Two, that literature can hurt people without helping them. And three, that in our valuations of literary texts and our pursuit of justice and equity in literary study, these two ideas must always cancel each other out. I wanted my students to understand, in other words, that ideology is textured and complex, and that we go to literature precisely for that complexity. Difficulty, whether aesthetic, formal, conceptual, ideological, or ethical, is something we should be cautious about shying away from. Discussions like the one we had about Diaz were both for me and for my students the most exciting part of the course, as we all learned to think about literature as a site of high-stakes interpretive struggle. When I gave my students information about the various ways in which readers, both scholarly and non-scholarly, had responded to the texts in front of them, they felt more authorized to pursue their own readings of that work. Which brings me to my basic thesis. That controversial texts, because they are hard and because they push us to the limits of what we are socially, ethically, and ideologically comfortable with, and because they often do so in ways that exploit our attractions and aversions to particular representative modes, are often where we develop our moral and interpretive imaginations. Students who are given the opportunity to grapple with difficult texts in the classroom become, in turn, both better at scholarship and more equipped to navigate controversies they encounter in their own lives. So I'll close here with an exhortation to the teachers in the room. Assign your students texts that challenge them in all possible ways. Be honest with them about the ways in which those texts are difficult, and be sensitive to the ways in which that difficulty might affect them. Invite them to think with you about the consequences of that difficulty, and trust them to rise to the occasion. Help them along the way when they struggle to do so, and recognize that it is our job to equip our students to navigate the complexity of their worlds.
Thank you, Emily and Professor Arkin. And thank you all for being here, and thank you to the BUCH for the invitation for me to come and talk with you today. When asked in a recent NPR interview about his provocative new Broadway play, Slave Talk, playwright Jeremy Harris said he wanted to provoke. I have not seen the play, which officially opens in a few days, but those who have report that it breaks many taboos about race and sex. In the process, it makes many audience members uncomfortable. When it ran off Broadway last year, protesters tried to shut it down. Irene Sophia Lucio, an actor in the play, told NPR, "I think that we're all into safe spaces right now, but we might need more brave spaces where people speak their truth and we start to lean in and listen to things that make us uncomfortable instead of walking away from each other." In a recent blog, Eboo Patel, the director of the Chicago-based Interfaith Youth Corps and an Ismaili Muslim, questioned whether safe spaces help minorities like himself to thrive in American colleges and universities. "There's something white about safe spaces," he argued, "at least as they are widely imagined in the academy." For an alternative, he looked provocatively to hip-hop and sports, both dominated culturally by black and brown people, and both articulating what he referred to as a battle ethic. "Perhaps there is something to learn in our seminars," he concluded, from what he described as more vigorous discussions. My time in college was exceedingly uncomfortable. In almost every course I took in the humanities, I felt like the dearly held beliefs I had brought to college as a 17-year-old were being pulled out from under me. By arguing vigorously for Marx's theory of value or against even the existence of Jesus, my professors challenged me to rethink the ideas that had made me who I was. So I walked around with a pit in my stomach for the last 3 years of my college experience. But I am exceedingly grateful for the education I got, for the way my professors and fellow students challenged me to test the truth of my assumptions. In my late 20s, I entered graduate school because of those professors and fellow students who had empowered me to change my mind. Today, I worry about the emphasis in American political culture and social media on maximizing discomfort. But I also worry with Harris and Lucio and Patel about the emphasis in American universities on minimizing discomfort. In my introductory religious studies course on death and immortality, I try to teach my students about religious traditions and texts that are not their own. I also try to defamiliarize them with their own religious texts and traditions to show them that there are many ways to be a Christian or a Buddhist or an atheist, not just one, and this can be uncomfortable for many people. I also try to challenge students to reckon with their own mortality, for example, by writing their own obituaries. One of the objectives stated on the syllabus is that for students and professors alike to realize that they are going to die. In all my courses, I try to get my students to argue with each other. This is hard. No one wants to be seen as intolerant, and arguing or even disagreeing, especially about such matters as race, gender, sex, and religion, is widely seen as a mark of intolerance. When I was in college, I argued with my friends all the time about politics, religion, philosophy. We did not consider this to be rude. In fact, we considered it to be respectful. If you took a friend's intellect seriously, you owed it to them to argue when you thought they were wrong, and they owed it to you to disagree with you. The Jewish tradition makes a helpful distinction here between two types of arguing: arguing for the sake of ego, which it does not value, and arguing for the sake of heaven, which it does. Today, our radio and television stations are clogged on both the left and the right with arguments on behalf of ego. The point is to cling to the answers you already have, even as you shove your answers down the throats of your antagonists. No wonder so many of my students are allergic to arguing. Arguing for the sake of heaven involves listening and responding. It is rooted in the assumption that there are partial truths on both sides of most important arguments. Only heaven has the full truth. The hope of arguments for the sake of heaven is communal, that together we will arrive at some higher understanding. Last year, I was at a weekend academic conference with other religious studies professors, and toward the end of the conference, one of the participants said that every inch of every campus in the United States should be a safe space for LGBTQIA people. The one professor there who identified as a gay man disagreed. "That's the difference between you and me," he said. "You are a Marxist and I am a Christian. Because I believe human beings are sinners, I don't believe that human institutions are perfectible, and I certainly do not expect my university to be a safe place for me as a gay man. I am not much of a Christian or much of a Marxist, but I do sympathize with this notion. I don't think BU can be safe, fully safe, in the sense that many use the term today. But I do think we should strive to borrow from Lucio to be a brave place. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much to everyone for having me. Before I became an academic, I worked as a rape crisis counselor and educator in San Jose, California. I worked directly with survivors of sexual assault, abuse, intimate partner violence, and other violations of consent in therapy sessions and classrooms in the emergency room at 3 a.m. So for me, the notion of the trigger warning is no mere abstraction or obligatory gesture of virtue signaling. It is a real and important technique in the pedagogical inventory that shouldn't be taken lightly. The notion of the entitled student who wants to be protected from all forms of challenge is largely a reactionary myth to discredit people with ongoing PTSD. At the same time, I have also been the author of plays with trauma-filled content. The play for which I've garnered the most recognition, called Goliath, features at its center a rape and murder of an Iraqi woman by American soldiers, although deliberately not graphically performed in the portrayal. The experience of the play, which is ultimately a feminist critique of hegemonic masculinity and imperialism, risks re-traumatization for those in the audience. Audience members have told me that the play is healing, that it allowed them to confront their own traumas and horrors in ways that enabled them to move forward in their lives, although I also don't know how many others in the audience have been triggered or hurt by the play as well. So now as a professor, as I teach works that contain trauma, because such works are often the ones that are the most important to teach, as Emily has argued quite eloquently, as they allow us to confront the affect of dynamics of power and oppression, I have to take into account both of these experiences. As educators in the humanities, we have a multitude of responsibilities. Among them, to engender a sense of critical thinking necessary for students to participate ethically in a democratic society. But secondly, we also have the responsibility to produce an equitable classroom environment, where those who have been historically marginalized and dispossessed, whether that be survivors of trauma, women students of color, queer and trans students, disabled students, are brought from the margins to the center of pedagogical consideration. These two principles are often in tension. In my experience, the trigger warning can oftentimes benefit this calculus between these principles, and it can oftentimes hurt it, depending largely on execution. Often, the trigger warning can prepare traumatized students for content that can bring back nightmares, anxiety, panic attacks, in such a way that could impair their capacity to learn in class. Sometimes, a trigger warning can have the opposite effect, producing an affective expectation for how a traumatized student is supposed to react. Moreover, sometimes the shock of the content can become a necessary component for the aesthetic experience of a work. This is certainly the case, for example, when I teach Intozake Shange's For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow is Enough, a medley of poetry and movement that bears witness to the intersectional experiences of Black women in America. But the play's poetics are specifically designed to uplift survivors and produce a sense of communitas. The challenge of the trigger warning is that it is not universally effective at guarding against re-traumatization, but there are some contexts in which it is absolutely essential. And it is difficult to know what those contexts are, given the wide range of students and their diversity of responses and experiences. But the most important way of ensuring the success of the warning or its absence is discussing with the students ahead of time what policy they would prefer, or alternatively, allowing some students to privately opt out of particular readings if it will impair their capacity to perform in the rest of class, as an instructor should usually treat a disability or accommodations request. But I'd like to emphasize an additional point. Within the American university, much has been said about the crisis of free speech, which is why I think a lot of us are here today. And typically, the parameters of this discussion focus on the question of whether PC culture has, quote, gone too far. Trigger warnings comprise a considerable proportion of this discourse, as is the question of whether to encourage the platforming of far-right provocateurs such as Milo Yiannopoulos to speak on college campuses. While I do believe that there is, in fact, a crisis in free speech in the American university, the discussion of trigger warnings and safe spaces is an ideological red herring for that debate. The implementation of trigger warnings and the protection of students from harassment does not curtail free speech, it enhances it. Such measures provide the historically marginalized with the validation that their existence, and thus their voices, matter to the debate when they would otherwise be silenced or self-censored. When I worked at the Rape Crisis Center, providing trigger warnings and being psychologically considerate was about restoring a survivor's freedom that had been taken away. Thus, the debate on trigger warnings must be kept within the question of pedagogical effectiveness rather than the broader liberal polemic of free speech rights. The real crisis of free speech lies within disparities of institutional power, as I think we'll hear from later panels today. Adjuncts and grad students' right to unionize and critique their administrations, for example. The fact that several of my women colleagues at BU, such as Professors Preston and Hamill, received hate mail and threats for daring to do anti-racist or anti-sexist work. The fact that I hesitate to talk publicly about the disenfranchisement of Palestinians because I don't have tenure yet, because I saw what happened to Stephen Salaita at the University of Illinois. These situations pose far more of a threat to campus free speech than the consideration of students' trauma. Thank you.
I'm so happy to be among such thoughtful colleagues. Two things, I think, that are important to know. One, I don't actually have a talk. I have some points that are sort of roaming around in my head. And two, in addition to being an associate professor, associate provost for diversity and inclusion, I'm also a professor of English, and for the majority of my career in the academy actually was teaching. And that's important just because of the way I'm thinking about these issues, both as a practitioner of diversity and inclusion, but also as a pedagogue. So I went to the dictionary to actually think through what the word difficult means, and then look to see what difficult texts mean. Difficult means needing much effort of skill to accomplish, deal with, or understand, which I think is important for those of us who are teachers in the room. So we're thinking about difficult texts. And difficult texts are texts that are syntactically challenging, for instance, or which present unfamiliar ideas, or more often, texts that call into question not only unfamiliar ideas, but ideas which challenge our perception of the world. And those two things, I think, are distinct from one another. So in conversations like this, it's my sense that we're often not really talking about texts that are syntactically challenging or even really texts that proffer unfamiliar ideas, especially if those ideas in some way can sort of easily abut our own systems of sense making. Mostly, I think we're not talking about the texts at all, as lots of my colleagues have gotten to, but rather about the human interactions that result from engagement with the text. So, that's sort of where I come into this. So I think we're actually wise to disentangle what it is about the text and what it is about the people talking about the text that is the issue. Because in so doing, we'd get to different solutions, one to do with what teachers teach and why, and one to do with who people teach and engage in discussions and what tools and habits of mind might be most valuable to the endeavor of fostering productive, challenging discussions. And so all of that to me is related to diversity and our increasing diversity in colleges and universities, especially in this country. So in thinking about heterogeneity, diversity, it is the case that diverse groups, so this is just some basic research, right? That diverse groups require more effort to successfully navigate than do homogeneous ones. And so for those of us teaching different from 20 years ago, right, our classrooms. And expectations, as you've heard from our students, are radically different. Research also tells us that heterogeneous teams actually do achieve better results. And one can easily surmise why that would be, right? It's that multiple angles of vision, addressing an issue or trying to solve a problem, if you have those angles of vision, you're bringing to bear to the problem more knowledge, different kinds of critical thinking, different kinds of creative thinking, and more in different contexts. So a way of thinking about that is if you live in a neighborhood where there has been an environmental catastrophe and you're given the option of choosing two teams of people to solve the problem, do you choose the team of people that is comprised of 6 water scientists, or do you prefer the team of people that is comprised of 2 water scientists, a public health expert, a physician, a mayor, and a structural engineer? I prefer the latter. And the data tell me that the latter is going to get to a better solution. So research also tells us that diverse groups require longer to come to a solution. And again, I'll go back to it, and they take more time to manage, right? So when you have all those different ideas in the room, it's actually harder work to get them sort of arranged around a product, but the product ultimately is better. And for those of us who teach radically diverse groups of people, that has been my experience. When there's a lot of diversity in the room, in the classroom, boy, those conversations are just appreciably deeper, richer, and more fulfilling. So to me, this is relevant because to difficult conversations, because as I've said, our classrooms are actually becoming more heterogeneous along many axes of identity. And so the question then to me about texts and that the texts that engender difficult interactions becomes a question about how heterogeneity impacts critical thinking. So then the next thing I've been thinking about is that I actually really believe that it is the responsibility of we, the faculty, or of teachers, to have two things. One, mastery of the knowledge, right? And two, to have mastery over how to impart that knowledge to students. And in my administrative role, I often am engaged with folks who are reluctant to change the way that they are teaching. So that's actually not reflected, I think, here with my colleagues. But many of the folks I'm dealing with are reluctant to change the way they're teaching in any way from the way they taught maybe 20 years ago in relation to difficult conversations. But if you just sort of flip that a little bit, we see that we as pedagogues do this all the time. So an example of this is... So not just in relation to material that is foreign to us that makes us uncomfortable or that we address reluctantly. So instances of our ability to be nuanced and responsive to student heterogeneity are evidenced everywhere. So for instance, a faculty member structures and teaches a first year undergraduate course much differently, or should do differently, than a graduate seminar. Right? So that is a kind of diversity, and we are responsive to it. And we don't take issue with that. It's typically we're taking issue with things to do with cultural, social, political identity. And this, to me, is the real issue. And the angst and discontent and disgruntlement of colleagues is, I think, related to a sort of more subtle thing that we often don't talk about, which I worry is a sort of fundamental supremacist belief in certain kinds of canons and a disbelief in other kinds of canons. Right. Mm-hmm. So that to me is fundamentally the question that I'm constantly asking myself. So as teachers, I think it's important that we recognize ourselves to be part of a larger whole, and that we live in a society defined by social norms where there are consequences when we breach those norms, right? So, and if we live long enough constantly, we're being asked to change our behaviors all of the time because the social norms are changing all of the time. The personal languages that we use are changing all of the time. Examples of this, terms like Oriental and Negro outside of thinking about texts, those aren't words that most of us use anymore, right? We'll use of Asian descent or we'll use African American because the social norms have changed. Likewise, when I was a kid, we used the word retarded all of the time. That's, retarded. It's outrageous. We wouldn't think to use that language in that way now because social norms have changed. So in relation then to what we teach, students are telling us that they want us to be better equipped to attain more knowledge about the world they live in, which requires those of us whom were educated, 20, 40 years ago, to think more capaciously about the material we're including in our syllabi and about the language that we use and or don't use. The classroom is not static, just as language is not static, just our social environment is not static. And a lot of the disgruntlement I get or that I experience when talking to colleagues is really rooted in a kind of static thinking and an unwillingness to be flexible in this regard. And so ultimately, the in this regard leads me to really ask, so what then is that about, right? What is the in this regard about? I'll leave it there.
All right. Thank you, all of you. Those were outstanding papers, and they seemed, you were lined up alphabetically, but somehow there was a flow that was actually really productive, and Crystal Williams' remarks at the end, I think, brought a lot of it together. There's a lot of different things to talk about. I think one of the things that seemed to be a through line in all of your talks and culminated really clearly in the remarks of Crystal Williams was the idea of time and how we deal with time management in the classroom in relationship to dealing with context versus content. And so what I mean by that is, as we come up with new methods and as we figure out how to interact with our students in more productive ways, more pedagogically effective ways, how do we then rethink the amount of material we can convey or put across in a given class, which of course has a strong relationship to questions of canon formation, pushing against traditional canons, producing new canons. These techniques we've been hearing about, and these specific examples we've heard about, seem to imply that we, in some ways, reduce the amount of material we put across, the number of texts, the number of images, and slow down at moments in order to talk about how we talk about these works. And so I'm wondering if everybody, if you have any thoughts about, in your own experience, and maybe this is less applicable for somebody who's still relatively new to the teaching game, but even in your case, Emily, is it all right if I use your first names? Is everyone Please. Okay with that, just for simplicity's sake? How you've thought about setting, in a practical sense, how you set up your syllabus in a way that both conveys a sufficient amount of material to cover the course framework, and at the same time allows you to stop and slow down and both intentionally speak to students about ways to deal with these difficult texts, and I think in another way of thinking about temporality there is unexpected things that you deal with on the fly, where you're having to slow down and wait, okay, I realize this conversation simply needs more time and we're going to not read this text for the next week in order to continue further with the one we talked about today. So do you have any thoughts about how you've recontextualized your syllabi, how you've thought about content versus context?
Big question.
I mean, so I have a sort of short answer to that. I have noticed, so for the class that I was talking about, ethnicity and identity, and many of my students for this semester are actually, many of my students for ethnicity and identity are actually in the audience at the moment, is that the syllabus gets shorter every year. Mm-hmm. And I spend more time on less material every year. And I initially made a move to only talk about non-American materials because some of the ideas are very difficult and somewhat explosive, and I thought taking it out of an American context actually made those things easier to talk about and avoided bringing up the U.S., and in fact, now I do the opposite. So I still have mostly non-American materials. It is an anthropology class, but I use those as a springboard. We understand it in a particular context and then bring it back to the U.S. after we've understood it in a sort of foreign context, and that takes a really long time.
Mm-hmm. So you actually divide up the semester?
No, not so much for every work we read. So a main concept that would come out of, for example, a chapter that we're reading about Kenya for the moment, then I try, okay, do we get it in this context? Okay, what does that look like if we try and import that into the U.S.? What kind of situations in the U.S. can we understand through this concept here? Mm-hmm. And so you're sort of doing double work with, right. Yeah. So, it, I mean, it's taking sometimes twice as long.
Right, okay, yeah.
One of the advantages of being relatively new to the world of undergraduate teaching is that you're always sort of on the fly, right? You're always building new courses when you're at this stage in your career, and that you're almost never beholden to the kind of static thinking that Crystal was talking about. And so I have always really understood my students to be collaborators in the experiments that are happening in the classroom, and I think that really helps me make some of my decisions and be flexible about how I'm thinking about content, workload, all of these things. But I also think that part of what at least I'm making a case for here is reimagining what we mean by content. Mm-hmm. So it is content, right, to talk about a public conversation in addition to a text. It's not necessarily that I'm assigning less, I'm assigning differently. And I think as a graduate student, you're almost always teaching first-year students or introductory courses, and those are courses in which I think it's very appropriate to take a sort of wider and shallower approach, as opposed to the deep dive that really generates those moments of slowing down and taking texts seriously and thinking really deeply through multiple lenses and taking multiple approaches to a particular text. So I think part of it is just like this is what it means to teach an introductory course. And part of it is this is what it means to be a teacher at a pretty experimental stage in a career.
I would just build on that and say I came into the academy as a teacher at a highly selective liberal arts college where the Socratic method was the norm. So my sense of teaching is exactly this, sitting around a table with a group of undergraduates and grappling with a question or a series of questions, right? And teaching them the habits of mind that allow them to ask critical questions of material that is beyond my classroom. So I think also at on the table is exactly this, like what is it, what are we teaching? Is it, I mean, there's a relationship between the amount of material, like actually just the facts, but also the skills that they need to go out into the world and be effective thinkers and doers. Mm-hmm. And the best class I ever had in my life was a woman from a law historian, a historian of the law, named Olive Taylor, who was at Howard University. And her position with us was, I don't want essays, I don't want homework, I want 3 blue book exams, I don't want any regurgitated dates. I know the dates. I want to know if you know how to contextualize the history of blacks and the law from 1910 to right now. Mm-hmm. And the first blue book exam I got back, I got a D. Because what she was asking me to do was think critically, and I had not been taught to do that. And from that, I extracted that, in fact, this thing that we do that is not just the material, but also helping students put information together, whether it's in the U.S. or external, that they should be able to leave their our classrooms and do that multiple ways.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with what you just said, Crystal. And I think that for me, canon formation is really not that important, frankly. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of different models to how to model and conceptualize pedagogy, right? And a more traditional way of thinking about it is that every student is an empty glass and you fill up the glass with water, with more knowledge, and they're just sort of empty vessels that they fill. But another way of thinking about them is to think about students as other knowledge producers, right? To think about them in conversation and to develop those critical thinking skills. So the question is, like, which texts will allow them to develop those critical thinking skills the most? Which will allow them to have these kind of dialectical ways of confronting and processing works? But of course there is still a politics to choosing those texts. I think, you know, regardless of the classes I teach, whether it's Asian American literature or contemporary drama, pretty much all the undergrad classes I teach, I always teach majority authors of color, just knowing the fact that the majority of their curriculum, they're not necessarily getting that. So it's sort of a political counterbalance in that sense. But a lot of those texts also are the ones that allows the greatest number of students to be able to find a personal entry point, mm-hmm. That allows them to get critically engaged. So.
Yeah, I would just add that I think it's important to think about what we're trying to, what you're trying to do in the classroom, right? And then that will, if you're teaching an AP course in physics, it's really important that the students learn the content.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to be tested on, so you don't want to get too distracted by interesting conversations. but if you're trying to do something else, and so I, in my death and immortality course, which has teaching fellows, I will say to them, look, if this is a conversation, and I say this to my students, here's what we're going to do in this class. We're going to have a conversation. When we're supposed to be talking about Gilgamesh, and all of a sudden we're talking about what it is to be a human being, or how it is that, people who think they're above other humans, like Gilgamesh, or people who think they're below other humans, like Enkidu, somehow enter into the human community, like, that's okay to get distracted by the question of, what is it to be a human being? And that's not a distraction, because the purpose of the class is to have a conversation. It's not to, learn certain data points about the Gilgamesh story. So I think with any class, you want to think about, as in any endeavor, you want to think about what you're trying to do. And the content will be more important in certain cases, and the conversation will be more important in certain cases.
Mm-hmm. Can I add one thing, which is just, I've worked with a lot of faculty around inclusive pedagogy, and the amount of sort of wide-eyed wonder at getting, quote, thrown off is really amazing. And so when I say that I think that our job is to actually have a good amount of knowledge over how to teach and what it is that we're teaching, that actually also includes being able to forecast where students are, what questions are going to emerge about the human condition, right? So that's a text and I'm sure, you sort of thought, this is they're gonna wanna grapple with this issue. And so I think that that's a responsibility that we don't often consider is ours, but it is. And therefore, we should be responsible to think about our syllabi not as just simply reactive, but actually proactive texts or documents that are proactively anticipating where students are going to want to break open and where difficult conversations reside in the material and in the ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering how each of you or some of you deal with getting feedback on the syllabi as you're developing them from colleagues. In other words, all the things we're talking about one can do on its own, but you're going to miss things if you're not sharing these ideas and putting putting all these efforts into the context of collaboration, which would probably mean collaboration with other faculty. And how do you find the time, how do you find the space to get feedback on these kinds of changes to your syllabi, the crafting of courses, the
building in of time for conversation versus content delivery. Do you have any good advice? Because I struggle with that, finding time to slow down and rethink the way we teach on a semester by semester basis.
I feel like I get a lot of feedback on that from my students. I tried different things and they just fall totally flat. Just don't do that. Don't do that anymore.
and that's all you need.
And then
you have to ask them though.
Well, you can tell. I mean, it just doesn't work. And then other text, it works.
Yeah.
So I think that's my main feedback loop.
Okay.
I'd say.
I have something funny to say, which is my strongest recommendation for syllabi is to keep it a Google Doc that students can access because it's going to keep changing. At least it is for me. But you know, what's actually nice is, I'm also still this is just my third year as faculty here, and so I still feel like I'm developing the syllabi all the time, and it is this sort of dialogue process with the students and figuring out what pace that they can handle, because you know it's sometimes hard to gauge that when you spend so much time in grad school, and then you know so it becomes a dialogue, and you figure out which texts are not going to necessarily be the most generative for the conversations that are having in the room. Mm-hmm. So I'm always dialoguing with the students about that, and I also have colleagues who are outside outside the university who are in my field who can give me additional feedback and additional ideas. So a lot of times I bring the syllabi to them.
Right. Maybe this is a good point to open up to questions from the floor. I don't know if is Slido. Ah, here's how this works. Okay. Great. Let's see.
Thank you.
So I'm going to read a question out, and this will be for the panel to think about. And then, of course, if any of you have questions and you want to walk up to one of the microphones, we can go back and forth between the posted questions and the live questions. So here's one. The question of content and reference to the physics course led me to a question. Do the panelists believe that questions of diversity are only for humanists?
No.
Next question. No. Maybe can we think a little bit more, though, about... Because that thought crossed my mind, too, as we were talking about the sciences. Stephen, you were talking very briefly about the sciences. Is there something about the humanities as a set of related, and sometimes only loosely related disciplines, that makes the humanities more amenable to these longer conversations around content and practice and method? Would we want to make that case?
I want to say it's not necessarily that it's just the humanities, but it is something about the humanities classroom. And maybe it's the fact that the Socratic method has been such a long-standing tradition in the humanities classroom that student-driven questions come to the center of what's happening in the classroom. Most of the time I'm teaching non-majors, and frequently what they want to do is bring the questions that our texts are raising to bear on the disciplines that they are engaged in. Mm-hmm. And that is always so productive and so interesting. I mean, we've had lots of conversations about scientific racism in my classroom, mm-hmm. and I'm so happy that we've had those conversations. And it was because we were reading Beloved, mm-hmm. you know, and that's such a fruitful place to go in an introductory humanities course. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think the humanities classroom is like the best laboratory for experimental thinking about how questions about diversity can apply to lots of other disciplines.
Mm-hmm. It's also true that in the humanities, social sciences, there are disciplines where those questions are central to the discipline, mm-hmm. right? And there are theorists and theories that are located, so, you know, critical race theory and et cetera, those exist in our spaces as more fully than they do, say, in the lab sciences. But, you know, I said no sort of blithely, but I meant no really seriously, for partially for the reasons that you just listed. In our lab sciences, for instance, the questions to do with heterogeneity and diversity and gender, et cetera, are key. They are really important. And departments are beginning to come slowly forward. I don't mean here at BU, but just generally in the nation, forward to try and figure out how do we incorporate some of these humanistic ways of thinking about diversity and tie that to the discipline of the lab.
I think it's a complicated question. I mean, I totally agree with Crystal that the humanities and the social sciences, and I think it is important that we make a distinction between those two, by the way. I think humanities and social sciences have looked at issues of race and diversity and gender and sexuality as more generally as their primary objects, insofar as we're sort of we can actually tear those categories apart. There is oftentimes a tendency within STEM and within the sciences to think about those categories as immutable, right? Mm-hmm. So we have male, female data points, and never mind that as if folks who saw Karen Workington's university lecture last year, for example, saw, right, is that there are very, very, very important biologists doing work in queerness and doing work in gender within the sciences, then who are also informed by humanities and social science approaches. I would also say that within the humanities, we shouldn't necessarily be on our high horse either, insofar as the fact that there is a sort of a problematic way in which the quote-unquote race novel becomes sort of a stand-in for the material experiences of people of color in the United States, for example. Right? If you read Jodi Malamed, she kind of goes into the whole description about that. So it's important for us to not overestimate the capacity of the humanities to teach us about these things that removes from their material experiences. I think it's just as important to study the environmental scientist who's examining disparities in environmental racism, for example, between different communities of color and the ways in which they experience, say, pollution, for example, right? So the sciences absolutely need to be part of that, even if they are being informed by humanities discourse, and the humanities really should not be seen as the only place or the monopoly for thinking about these issues.
So I agree with that. I think importing the kind of content of the questions that are being grappled with in the humanities and social sciences, because those are objects of humanities inquiry and social science, is really important. But in terms of thinking about pedagogical differences between classrooms, I was just thinking that what makes diversity in the classroom central to the learning experience is bracketing the ultimate answer that you want to establish, right? As having that be the outcome of the conversation rather than something that's actually predetermined prior to it, right? That's where the diversity of perspectives actually matters. That's why you have a conversation in the first place, because if you already know the answer, why are you bothering? And so I think the question is really not about, is it humanities or social sciences? It's who gets to bracket what the final outcome is and then actually benefit from the conversation, and who can't, under what circumstances and why. And so perhaps it is easier in certain contexts in humanities and certain social sciences, not all, to bracket that end answer, or to have there be multiple answers that are possible, and maybe it's more difficult.
I would only add that I've also seen more and more students from the STEM fields coming into my lecture courses, and whether that's a result of the hub or just people's general interest, and I've seen multiple times students who study the sciences, STEM fields in general, computer science, have actually brought a lot to the conversation around the images we're talking about, and some of it's real baseline factual kind of information. We were having a discussion about a contemporary artist who was appropriating people's images from Instagram, and it was the computer scientist who could stand up and say, well, here's how intellectual property rights actually functions in relationship to Instagram, and I hadn't known that before. So
terrific.
So that is, I think that relationship, it can go both ways. I have a couple of great questions here, and this, I think the first one segues from this one pretty nicely. If we are to teach free thinking and inquiry, how do we create measurable data for assessment? It's a real issue, because we are, in fact, dealing with this question of assessment in a pretty serious way at BU and across the country. We're dealing with learning outcomes. Somewhere in there, at some point in the year, around November, we all have to report in and sort of say how we've been measuring the impact of our teaching on some level, and different departments handle that differently. Does anyone have any good advice on how to deal with that issue? I mean, there's the question of testing.
That sounds like a provost office question.
It is actually a provost office question. I am not the provost to ask it. That person would be Jillian, who is not here among us today. I should know, have a good answer for you, but I don't.
All right.
There's that famous Talmudic passage. I'm going to get all of the details of it wrong, but the question is whether an oven is kosher. And there are two sides to the debate, and God keeps intervening in all of these flagrant ways on one side of the debate, and the other side actually wins. And then mm-hmm. God dances in heaven and says, my children have defeated me. Yay! Right? They should defeat us, and then we've won. But I don't know how you measure.
So, Peter, do you want to pose a question?
There's also a person there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not turning this way enough. Gina, do you want
to? Okay. So I'm going to start. I'm Gina Sapiro. I'm in the political science department. I'm a social scientist, and I specialize in political cognition and the way people see each other and deal with each other. And I'm going to start in a slightly different place from where I was, and that is I would call for more modesty. A panel of humanities people is not the group to ask whether the humanities are different from others. I would turn and say, is there someone from another field who can help us? Because I heard a lot of just wonderful assumptions of how social science works, physics. Come on, Stephen, is there an end to the universe? And if there is an end to the universe, what's after that? And if there's not, where does it stop? That's a physics question. So let
it's
me
not
go
an AP
to,
question, though.
Yeah. You'd be surprised. So what I wanted to ask about and mention is the problem of assumptions of some of the categories. I want to use the word space, which has been used a lot and which we all use. In the context you're discussing, space is not a physical place. A space is a psychological place that we enter. And the problem is that a safe space cannot be equally safe for all people, because the notion of safety implies the notion of danger. And the question is, what are the dangers to each of us? And in the classroom, which dangers and which safety do we privilege? Because, as you know, if you think about it, underneath the discussion here, there was a lot of privileging of certain senses of danger that come from places we assume are less privileged versus other kind. And we need to ask where that comes from. The other question is our assumptions about the people we're dealing with and who we think they are and who we think we are. Let me refer to something that Crystal mentioned, which is how classrooms are different from where they were and that they're more diverse than they were. In many institutions, they are. They also may be differently diverse from the way they were. But if you talk about classrooms 30 years ago, and I experienced them, I'm going to talk about age in a minute. In classrooms 30 years ago, there are people whose various positionality was totally silenced. So you wouldn't know if there was someone gay there. You wouldn't know if there was someone there who felt that they were in the wrong gender. And in fact, as we all know, when we look at people, we don't know by looking at them what race they think they are necessarily. We don't know what gender they think they are. We don't know about their sexuality. We don't know a lot about a lot of things. And that, I think, for a teacher, is crucial to understand, that we cannot make assumptions about who is in our classroom, even if we have them introduce themselves and give us a fun or a boring factor, however it is we do it. I think we also, sorry to go on, this is the last thing, I think we also have to be careful about which categories of people we're sensitive to and which we're not. So one of the ones that people are not sensitive to, that I understand more and more, is, for example, age and generation. People are not sensitive to what it means to be old. So there are lots of assumptions about how old people think, how inflexible we are, what we experienced before. And that's because none of you have experienced being older than you are, nor have I. It is not clear to me, either by reading the cognitive research or many years of mentoring young students. I had a job once where that was one of my jobs. It is not clear to me that younger faculty are more flexible in the classroom. Quite the opposite, because it takes a while to gather that confidence, that distance from what your teachers taught you, and that distance from being surrounded by your own generation that often leads teachers to need to begin to learn to be more flexible and move more. So maybe the bottom line here is I struggle with modesty, and I think in this discussion, we all need to struggle with modesty.
Thank you very much. Does anybody want to pick up on that?
I'll take up the physics physics question. Just because I'm too old to remember what you said after that. But I actually started college as an astrophysics major. That was my happy year. And I was really attracted to the cosmological questions, you know, that that physics theorists, astronomers are so good at confuzzling. And I actually have never thought about that as a entry for me into religious studies, but it may well have been, because that's the stuff I was reading in physics that really interested me. Were these questions about, you know, what are these black holes and what was this, you know, what happened before the Big Bang and how can there have been no laws of nature at some moment, 1 second prior to the moment that we know about? These are very profound kinds of questions that we do think about as humanity, you know, humanity in our parochialism about as humanities questions and aren't at all confined to the humanities. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Criticism.
Did you want to? You were up there next, I think, and I see you as well. If everybody could just say who you are
it's
when you come up to the mic.
It's this. Oh, it's on now. Peter Schwartz, World Languages and Literatures. Takeo used a phrase that caught my attention: depending on execution, which seems to me to raise a whole lot of problems or questions that are important to us. The question of the relationship of regulation to execution, of policy to praxis, which implies also a relationship of administration to professoriate, I think, the difference between rules and judgment about their application, or to use a favorite concept of mine, tact. Where does tact come into this equation? Mm-hmm.
Tact. Okay.
That's a question for all of you.
Well, now we're all trying to be modest.
It's very tactful.
You're not going to get an answer.
Well, the word respect came up a lot, I noticed, in some of the talks, and I wonder if there's a way to create a relationship between thinking about tact and respect in the classroom. I mean...
Peter, if I may, it's an excellent question, and I think, if I may sort of follow up, are you also sort of asking about the way in which implementation would happen in terms of policy and that sort of thing as well?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure, frankly. I mean, I think that it is a difficult question because once you start introducing the question of what is governmentally allowed by the university, then it becomes an entirely different question, right?
That is part of how the question is tends to be posed.
For sure. But I also think that a lot of the discourse around trigger warnings and around campus free speech is also around the perception of this mob of undergrads who allow and disallow speech, when really the question of allowance and disallowance really is in regards to university administration. So a lot of what I was trying to talk about was I wanted to sort of bust the bubble about the undergrad mob, as it were, or the student mob. But in terms of like whether or not university administration should allow or disallow or require certain measures, such as the trigger warnings, such as, various. It's not entirely clear. I think it does depend on the context of what each university has been struggling with and the context of what the student needs actually are. But I do hesitate about, whether or not some of these things should be absolutely mandated or the ways in which, things would get enforced. So I don't know if other folks have other ideas.
I just wanted to link the problem of modesty and the question of tact. And I gave this talk that makes it sound like I actually know what I'm doing in the classroom, which I don't. Usually. And in fact, I think the issue of really never fully knowing the people who are sitting in the classroom with you and having it be a mutual exploration every time you stand up in front of them and try to have a conversation makes it both exciting and actually terrifying to be a teacher. And so, I mean, I feel like every semester it's an unfolding revelation of who they think I am, who I think I am in the classroom, who they think they are, and a kind of mutual discovery that both requires an enormous amount of tact, but you don't even know exactly how to do that because, again, you don't know who's sitting in the audience, and you can never, right? So sometimes I feel like, okay, well, now today I'm completely tongue-tied. I don't know what to say about anything because I'm worried, right, about X, Y, Z, A, B, and C in terms of how are my imaginaries of who these students are going to take this particular concept. So I think that unease, faculty unease. We've been talking about student unease, but faculty unease, I don't know how to embrace that as part of a pedagogical sort of strategy, but it seems like my discomfort, because I'm so aware of what I don't know about the students, could be a productive place for sort of thinking about this mm-hmm. outside of university mm-hmm. regulations. But again, I mean, people are, I think, more comfortable announcing their positionality, whether they're more diverse or less diverse, and in what ways they're diverse, right? My classroom is differently diverse every semester. It depends on what mm-hmm. course I'm teaching. So I do think that that's a really important point, particularly, I mean, in cases like mine, where we deal with explosive contemporary issues, right? Even if I try to start talking about them in Kenya, they end up, anyway.
Yeah, I think if there's a strategy I'm advocating here for dealing with both the issue of modesty and the issue of tact, it's transparency. It's being really upfront mm-hmm. with your students about why the thing we're doing together is hard. Mm-hmm. And letting them understand that it's hard for you and that you're coming to it having thought a lot about that difficulty and having reservations and feelings and opinions of your own. And being forthcoming about that, I think that there's a way in which we conflate authority with being inscrutable mm-hmm. to our students, and I've never found that to be a successful strategy.
I would build on that and just say when I two things, and it took me several years of teaching to Gina's point, to get comfortable enough to do this. One, and in part I'm able to do this because of what I teach, right? I teach the production of art. So we're sitting around a table, we're talking about their own art, other people's art, et cetera. Often that's what we're doing. There are two strategies that I always employ is to talk about the sort of creative inclinations and strengths that I bring when I'm looking at, right, someone else's work. Right, some are very audio, like an auto person, et cetera. And other folks are imagists and other folks, blah, blah. And so we go around the room and actually talk about what sort of natural inclination is when you're looking at literature and at someone else's work. And I do that in part because I want to model that the multiple kinds of diversity in this regard, what you're bringing to the page, is valuable as a collective tool. Right, a collective learning mechanism, but I'm also trying to also model for them that your individual diversity beyond that skill is also a value. All the lenses that you bring are a value and are worth putting out into the world of the classroom so that we can create something together. So that's one of the things that I do really regularly as a strategy, and the other strategy, frankly, that I you know, use all of the time in the classroom, at least, is to ask questions, to really ask, like, to say, I don't know, like, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes I use it as a rhetorical strategy because I think I actually do know, and I just want to model the thing. but often I don't really know, and so I'll say, I don't know, like, what, right? So you're smart people. Let's talk it out. Let's work it out. And the act of doing that, I think, creates a kind of tact and respect for the ideas and input of others. And it also does fundamentally decenter my own authority in some way in the classroom, right? It suggests a collective effort that I prefer in my classrooms.
I know we have a few people waiting at the microphone. You've been very patient. I wanted, if I could just throw in one Slido question, and if we could come up with maybe sort of just a practical set of responses, because I think it builds on what we've just been talking about. The question is, how do you handle teaching a novel or idea about race to a student whose ethnic or racial background differs from your own? Sort of building on this theme of difference and diversity, you're shaking your head.
Well, I'm just laughing because I'm like, that's
what he does.
That is what you do.
All okay. The time.
That is what you do.
I don't know. That's, I just teach it.
It just happens.
Sorry. So, but there's a fear that's under that question, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some sort of a level of uncertainty. Is it that? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it, right? Is the concern that the material isn't translatable to someone who's outside? Like, is Toni Morrison not translatable mm-hmm. to white people? Right? Like, there are a series of things that I think people worry about, and I'm not sure what actually is the worry that fuels that question.
Okay. Well, then, all right, fair enough. Let's do it.
It's interesting, too, what kind of foreignness you impute to a text, right? Because okay. if you're reading about the Buddha or you're reading about Guru Nanak, who starts the Sikh tradition, I think the primary thought of a student is that, like, this is a weird religion, rather than, like, this is a brown person, mm-hmm. or maybe this is a man, that it's just like, ooh, that's a weird religion I've never heard of, or, ooh, cool, that's a weird religion I've never heard of. So it is interesting how this goes a little to Gina's point about, you know, what do we see and what you know don't we see? Do we see, you know, the Buddha as a brown person, as a man, as a really old person, mm-hmm. as a crazy person, as, you know, an enlightened person? How do we brand him in terms of attaching to our own anxieties about the text?
But mm-hmm. but also there's something more complicated to it. I mean, I think it's that, but I also think, you know, I grew up, I was a voracious reader. And I don't think anyone would ever have asked, how do you expect Crystal to read Faulkner and connect?
Thank you. Oh, that's right.
Right?
Thank you.
So I will just say again, what is that about? Right? If it's the work of people of color or LGBTQIA or whatever that, right, the other, it, like, what is it that causes us to feel so unsettled about the teaching of otherness? What is otherness, and other to what, and what is the normative thing that you are using as your default?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the fear of saying the wrong thing, you know, saying,
maybe
misunderstanding, making assumptions about somebody else. So I think it's a question that a lot of people do ask themselves, but yeah. Okay, I think I can see the time is, yes. Please.
Hi, I'm Claudia Friedel. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I work at the Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University Libraries. And my question for all of you is, how do you envision this happening outside of the classroom? As an archivist, I work with metadata and often describing or giving the guidelines for people to describe materials we have in collections. Often those materials are problematic. There's sensitive materials, there's controversial materials, there's very triggering materials. So I think this idea of content and context extends outside of the classroom and to the resources that are available on campus for students in terms of resources and spaces they can go to for research. So with that in mind, what what sort of like expectations do you have for archivists to uphold in terms of interpreting stuff like that for users? Because often there's very little description that will be involved when somebody goes to find something. So you could open up a folder and it might describe three or four things in it, and then you might find something that's very controversial. Am I tethered enough in this question?
Does anyone have a... I think it could be linked to pedagogical practices even within the BU campus, because along the Gottlieb Archive, it's like, do you send students there? Do you help them to discover texts that you're not providing them?
I think this is such an interesting question, and I've never thought about it before, because part of what you're doing when you send students to the archive is authorizing them to make discoveries, right? Like, it's not archival work if someone has already done all of the description of the thing. Like, there's not interesting research to be done if that's already happened. And I don't know. I mean, so much of what you find in archives is all of the things that you say is triggering and troubling and bad in a lot of ways, but also interesting and important to incorporate into our research. So I think that I would urge my students to take the habits of mind that we develop in the classroom and apply them to the things that they find in the archive. And I really hope to incorporate more archival assignments in my teaching going forward. Yeah.
It's a really, really, really interesting question. So the principle I'm operating off of is always consent, right? So the question, so I think the challenge is when you're teaching in the classroom, right? So when you're giving a text that they're not necessarily, they're consenting by taking the class, but they're not fully aware of what it is that they're reading, right? The archive is, I feel like archival assignments are usually a little bit different, because I think for the most part, they're generally choosing which archives to search out themselves, right? And a lot of times when they come upon these types of resources, it's a lot of times it's their choice. So it can be triggering for sure, right? It can absolutely be triggering. But it's not necessarily the removal of their consent, right? So the exploration is their prerogative. And sometimes they can be triggered, but it's not necessarily removal of their power. Right. So for me, I think it's my initial instinct is that it's a different context within the archive because of the self-determined nature of the work. But it depends. I don't know. It's a great idea to have the kind of mental health resources available on hand via the archives and thinking about that. Just for sure.
Okay, we need to keep moving. Thank you very much. Maybe we'll move to this aisle.
Adela Pineda, Roman Studies, Latin American Studies. Thank you very much. It was very interesting. I have a question, kind of like Peter's, has to do with the relationship between instructor, student, and institution. And this comes to mind when Takeo talked or gave two examples regarding trigger warning vis-a-vis traumatized students and institutional policy vis-a-vis his personal political opinion. So in this sense, you see the role of the institution in two very opposite directions. So are we afraid of the institution, or are we afraid of hurting students' feelings? How can we bring these two very, very difficult topics together within the corporate model of the university? Thank you.
Anyone want to take that on? Okay. Thank you. I do think we have to, I'm sorry, but we are getting down to about 5 minutes, I think, and I think we aim to stay very much on schedule today, so please.
I'm Kate Viens from American and New England Studies. In order to promote safe psychic spaces and in the context of changing social norms, I was wondering what the role of the university is in promoting common really moral values. Out of curiosity, I took a look at the mission statement for my husband's alma mater, which is Notre Dame, and they affirm academic freedom in the context of a pursuit of truth and trying to promote a climate of justice, respecting what other people own, and self-discipline, which is, you know, temperance. I mean, the cardinal virtues were wrapped in that mission statement. And I'm wondering what the university's role, as I say, is in promoting a common culture of common values.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. We've been. Have you at all attended any of the free speech sort of open forums that we've been hosting over the course of the last month or so?
I'm so sorry.
I mean, it's actually really a rhetorical question. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have put you on the spot like that. The reason I was asking that is because the question about so I was on the policy committee, so the committee that drafted this draft that we've been sort of circulating. And there are some, I mean, there is one possibly moral imperative that's embedded in this thing, which is that the university has a responsibility, well, two. The university has a responsibility to meet speech with more speech, right? To sort of ameliorate some of the negative impacts of particularly hateful speech, for instance, although that's not really the language that's there. And then the other is that the university has a moral obligation to, although I'm not sure we would have said it this way, to ensure that the functioning of the university, that education is able to happen. Those seem to be the two kind of qualities that we were focused on. Unlike Notre Dame, which I think is what Catholic, and therefore, right, driven by a kind of very clear moral imperative, ours is not a university that is driven by a kind of religiously related moral imperative. So I think that I guess that's the answer, that education and community are foregrounded. And that seems to me to be as strong a statement in terms of the moral position as I can imagine. Does that seem right to you?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, he's on the operation. Yeah.
Thank you. It is interesting to think, though, about to what extent... Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No. Okay. About to what extent BU is a liberal Protestant institution, because we do have our first non-Methodist president ever, is our current president. Before that, all our presidents were Methodist. Wow. And this university began in the 1840s as a Methodist seminary. And it evolved into a liberal arts institution. And one thing then in religious studies we are interested in is the ways that Protestantism kind of is always lurking, in the Supreme Court, in presidential elections, in universities, in religious studies programs that privilege Protestant terms and questions, that think texts are the most important things in religions rather than maybe rituals. We could be doing a panel now on difficult rituals instead of on difficult texts, but that would out us as Catholics rather than Protestants. So I do think that that's that question of our, BU being a non-religious place, there are lurking religious influences here.
Did you read the draft document? Have you read it yet?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yes, it is. I will say, outside of this place, I might wonder with you aloud what you see lurking beneath the draft that is sort of, filtering around. It's such an interesting issue. So fascinating.
Real quick? 30
yeah. seconds.
Yeah. To try to answer both of your questions, I think that in a lot of ways it's actually quite productive to distrust any university from a top-down perspective, insofar as the material investments of the university are going to be towards, growing endowments and so forth, right? I think the important thing is for us to imagine community among each other and to imagine community with students and with fellow workers at the university. I think that's how we achieve the goals that we want to achieve.
Can we do one more question? Are we okay? I know we're bumping up against 11. Okay, please.
So I'm Jasmine Barrington. I'm in the English department. I'm a PhD candidate. And my question, I think all of you can speak to it, but how do you teach culture as an aesthetic performance? Thank you.
Culture is an aesthetic performance. Okay.
Culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
she said culture.
Right. So I teach culture as an aesthetic performance and so much else at the same time. So we always have to attend to
the things that people are doing and how the things people do transform who they think they are and how they think about the world and about other people. I mean, I don't exactly know how to answer the question because it is part and parcel of every aspect of human self-presentation and decoding of others, right? Everything we do in some ways could be conceived in some way as an aesthetic performance, the languages we use, the terms, the way we speak. So I try to attend to that in a whole range of ways and talk about its flexibility, the ways we try to fix it, what those fixings mean. I don't really have a short answer for that.
I don't have an answer either, but I have a sort of like a reframing of the question, and that is like, in our classrooms, how do we attach aesthetic performances to culture? How do we read them as representations of certain kinds of cultural expression or cultural traditions? And that's a question I think is worth posing to students rather than like dictating an answer to, particularly in classrooms where representation of multiple kinds of cultural expression becomes important to the mission of the course.
Yeah. Okay, we do have time for one more question, and we're going to take a Slido question, and I'm trying to find the right one here. Oh boy. You gave me a prompt, and now I'm not seeing the question.
Coming back.
Yeah. Did you want to actually point this to me? Because I want to make sure I'm answering. So, final question before we take a break. What is the role of commodification in higher ed, and is it more difficult to challenge students who are customers, particularly in the humanities?
That's true.
That's a great question.
That's a great question.
I don't even understand it.
Does a student's tuition dollars, to the extent that a student is spending tuition money, you know, everybody coming in with different financial backgrounds, is there some kind of purchasing power as part of being a student that it leads to ideas, I think, of entitlement and takes us back actually to questions of trigger warnings and safe spaces and
what are students owed as consumers of this product?
That's what I'm reading into the question.
That's so interesting.
Anecdotally, I tend to get that type of attitude less from the students who want safe spaces, though. I think these are two separate questions.
Okay.
I mean, I do think the university, BU, and American universities operate inside consumer capitalism, capitalist culture, where we are trained from when we're tiny, that we, a large part of who we are is choosers and expressors of preferences and articulators of preferences, and that we differentiate ourselves from others by the things that we buy. I think it's really powerful. I mean, we have conversations in our department about student evaluations and the way those articulate preferences that may not have to do much with the content or the quality of the course, but may have to do with the way the professor dresses or whether the professor is a man or a woman or... And I think it's a really important question because the Obama administration's guidelines about that I think pushed a lot of universities and students towards preferences around STEM rather than preferences in the humanities. Mm-hmm. Right. Why? Because the purpose of a college education is to buy you something, is to get you a right. job. Like, so when you make the choice about your school, if you have a choice, it's instrumental. Mm-hmm. And it's instrumental toward employment. Right. And so the whole old-fashioned idea of the university as a place where human beings are made, where critical thinking is performed and is learned and tested, I think does run aground to some extent on the rocks of the consumer mindset and the demands of the commodification protocols.
Yeah. So, well, just as an art historian, I hear what you're saying because Obama specifically singled out art history as an example of a useless degree.
A useless purchase. Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I mean, you said instrumentality, and I wrote down instrumentality. I fear, if I pull back a little bit, higher ed is part of a larger context in which we in this country think about almost everything through instrumental lenses, yep. right? And right. I fear it is deeply, deeply unhealthy. We are loath to talk about spirituality. We are loath to talk about morality. We are loath to talk about personhood and holistic ways of being anymore. And so higher ed is just one way in which we think instrumentally about how we are in our lives. And I think also higher ed as an institution has done actually a miserable job of talking about the value of critical thinking, of development, of engagement, et cetera, right? We broadly have done a very bad job. But it's not surprising in that when we were making an argument for the value of higher ed as a national security interest, right, in what the 50s or, you know, right. That also was an instrumental position.
Yeah.
So that we, right, so if you start with a national discussion about the value of higher ed through instrumental lens, it shifts and mutates. And so I think we're in very dangerous territory, not only with respect to higher ed. It's a real problem.
I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I do think this is yet another conversation that can be constructively invited into the classroom. I think asking students to think about the purpose of their education.
Yeah.
And you can bring educational theory, you can bring lots of texts about the purpose of higher education into your classroom as texts to engage with critically, and I've done that in my classes with a lot of success. And students are more willing to put pressure on the assumption that they're customers than you might think when you give them the chance and guide them through that conversation.
Agreed, and I think one thing to add, I agree with everything that y'all said, but in addition, I think it's important that we don't blame them for it, right? This is the world we built for them.
Yeah, that's right. They've inherited it. And
there's a tremendous amount of intergenerational pressure, right? People are making yes. a huge financial investment in college, yes. right? So there's a logic to it that...
Mm-hmm. I think this is where we'll break. And thank you very much to all the panelists. Thanks to the people who asked questions. And thanks to all of you for coming. So 15-minute break, I think, and then the next panel will commence.